Okay, good afternoon everyone. Thank you for coming along. So John and Ash have got a pretty interesting presentation to go through this afternoon, talking about drivers of common law payments. I'm not going to spend any time on their bio. It seems to be the trend of the day. Most of the presentations have been running pretty close to time, so we might just kick off. So please give a warm welcome to John and Ash. There will be question time later on. If you can, please use the mic. That would be great. Thanks.
I'm John, by the way. Yeah, so common law portfolio is something that's always changing. So precedents get set, politicians like to get involved, and legislation changes. And while all of that is going on, the underlying risk profile of the portfolio is undergoing change. So the individuals or entity that make up the portfolio become more or less risky. And so given all that, when you're looking at some changes in experience, a natural question to ask is, well, to what extent is this change being driven by the environment, in particular the common law environment, and to what extent is it just reflecting changes in the underlying risk mix of the portfolio? And is there a way to reliably kind of quantify and measure the difference between the two? So we had a bit of a think about this, and we've managed to do it. We have. And the slides have changed, so I guess that's it. No, not working.
Start chatting.
All right, I'll just start chatting. All right. Yeah. So in particular, what we've done is to show that you can isolate and measure the impacts of common law changes, and that by doing that, you gain extra insight into what's really driving your portfolio. And you can also find some interesting things out when you do that, such as that legislative change can actually have quite different effects on different segments of the portfolio, which is not necessarily something you would have thought of initially. Changing the slide. So ideally what you want in order to do this is, we're actuaries like a lot of data, and the ideal is a industry-wide claims-level database that's publicly available. That doesn't really exist in Australia, but we did get one from the US, which covers medical malpractice payments since 1992. So it's a really rich data set, and it covers a period where in the US they had a lot of tort reform and a lot of changes to the way that MedMal was regulated in many of the states. I've got a waving at the back. Try it now. Yeah. All right. Anyway, that's the slide you missed out on before, but I'm going to skip past it to that one. It's got a lot more words on it. So it's a great data set because it covers a period both before, during, and after a lot of legislative changes. It's publicly available. All malpractice payments since 92. We've restricted our analysis to only primary care practitioners, so physicians, surgeons, and GPs. And even doing that, we get about 290,000 records, 290,000 individual awards. The purpose of the data set is not really for actuarial analysis. The purpose is to track physicians as they move between states or between hospitals so that their record of malpractice payments, but also their record of other disciplinary actions, such as having their license revoked, goes with them and can be looked up. So entry to the database is strictly enforced, and it's as such a very complete data set. There's some things that would be nice to have that it doesn't have. It only contains non-zero paid awards, so actions that get brought but settle for $0 aren't in it. It doesn't contain the date of report, which for a long-tail line is quite a useful thing. But even so, it's got a lot of stuff in there that makes it very rich. So it's got details on the practitioner, so what their specialty was, the nature of the action, how old they were when they graduated, what state they were in, and so on. So it does have a lot of stuff, and you can do a lot with it. I said it covers a period from 92 to now, so 20-odd years, where there was a lot of change in the US malpractice market. A lot of these changes mirrored what went on in Australia's PI market in general and medical indemnity in particular. In the period leading up to 2001, they had pretty rapidly increasing losses. They went from total malpractice payments across the country of about $4.5 billion to about $6 billion over the period of a few years. This led a lot of insurers to raise their premiums quite strongly, in some cases more than doubling them, and those premiums were already at over $100,000 to start with. So the doctors got up in arms. They said, we can't practice under these conditions. We can't pay this much in malpractice and still keep a viable business going. And in some cases, in Texas, for instance, they went on strike. While all this is going on, it's sort of a classic hardening insurance market. Some insurers that weren't in the market decided that with these premium increases, it's a good time to get in, and so they did. But overall, the main trend was for insurers to leave the market. And some of the bigger players were leaving. Culminating in 2001 with St. Paul's, which was writing business in about 45 states, completely pulling out of the US malpractice market. And so it created a sort of a vacuum of supply of malpractice insurance, and where there was supply, the premiums were very, very high. So a lot of states decided that they actually had a crisis. They were seeing physicians, anecdotally physicians, moving state to states with lower premiums and also refusing to perform certain high-risk procedures. The effect of the crisis, if you like, varied quite strongly between states. So this is a chart of the average award size per practitioner. So that's sort of a proxy for average premium in the period leading up to the changes that we'll see. And the variation across the states is quite stark. So going from about $4,000 to more than five times that amount, $21,000 in some states. My US geography got a lot better after we were doing this, but that bright red one there is Pennsylvania, and that one's New York, in case you're wondering. Anyway, so a lot of states decided they needed change. Rick Perry in Texas was in particular very vocal about bringing in change to the malpractice. And when they were looking at what to change, and thinking of what to change, well, they did the same things that governments do everywhere when a common law portfolio is growing uncontrollably. It's basically three things you can do. You can change the settlement structure, you can restrict access to the courts, or you can provide some government subsidies via state-funded schemes. In Australia, we pretty much did all of those following the IPRA report, and in MedMel in particular, there were various government schemes set up to subsidise Australian medical indemnity riders. In the US, a lot of the debate was around the introduction of damages caps, so caps to particular heads of damage. And they took the inspiration from this from a previous crisis that they had in the 70s and 80s, where a lot of states, and there those the kind of brownie-coloured ones, brought in caps. And the forerunner of those is California, which brought in a non-indexed $250,000 general damage cap. Anyway, given all this, after 2001, 2002, you're in a very nice sort of position data-wise, because you've got both longitudinal information, so time-based information from before and after the reforms, and also cross-sectional information, because some states always had the caps in, some just brought them in, and some just stayed as they were, including Pennsylvania, which was quite bright red before. Anyway, so but more or less the states that brought in the caps were aligned quite strongly with having very high average premiums and very high claim size experience. And you say, well, what happened after all these reforms came in? Well, the total cost went down quite markedly, and it really does kind of look like a wave cresting over. And you look at this and you say, well, there's only really some states that brought in the reforms or brought in stringent damages caps. So if you're looking at it on a total market basis, to what extent is it the reforms that are being reflected here, and to what extent is it just changes in the mix of the business? Well, the first thing you can do is say, well, I've actually got three different groups of states here. I've got what I call the no-cap states, so the ones that never had them, the new cap, the ones that just brought them in around the period 2002 to 2004, and ones that never had any at all. And when you do that, and you look at it on an incident year basis, because that's sort of how the reforms attach, what you notice is that actually all three groups of states are trending down after about 2002. It's more strong in the new cap states, but it's certainly present even in the states that have never had any caps on damages. And given that, the trend that you see in the new cap states is almost certainly a combination of effects, one from the introduction of the caps themselves, but also reflecting some national trend that's affecting all the states. You get a similar picture when you look at frequency. Again, it's trending down quite strongly across all of the groups. Much stronger in the NUCAP states, and when we looked at this, we were a little surprised by that. General damage caps in the US act very differently from Australia. So in Australia, there'd be certain requirements you need to reach to get different levels of general damages. In the US, it really is just a hard cap. So typically what would happen is it'd be a jury trial. The jury will say, we'll find for the plaintiff $1 million in general damages, or non-economic loss, as they call it. The judge will say to the jury, you know, thanks very much, and turn to the plaintiff and say, well, they gave you $1 million, but in this state we've got a $500,000 cap, so you can only have $500,000 of that, which is why a lot of trial lawyers in the US challenge the caps on constitutional grounds, and they sort of go out and come in periodically in different states. The drop in the frequency, anecdotally, what they've been seeing is that lawyers are more reluctant to take on cases with lower economic damage potentials. So in the US, economic loss is generally uncapped, and so it's in the lawyer's best interest to take on cases from more affluent people, because they'll have a higher chance of getting a big award, as is reflected in that Wall Street Journal headline from about 2002-2004. So that's kind of a broad aggregated cross-sectional analysis of what's going on, but we haven't yet looked at whether there was changes to the portfolio of physicians in the US that were contributing. And I'll hand it over to Ash to talk about that.
All right, thank you, John. Yeah, so what we've seen so far is, I guess, putting graphs on anecdotes, really, and that's a lot of what exists in this area about how tort reform affects average damage sizes. Anecdotes and some graphs around how, you know, caps can decrease claim frequency and general damages sizes. What the data has allowed us to do in this particular instance is to add a little bit more sophistication to it, to be able to actually take pictorial anecdotes like this and turn it into evidence about not just whether caps work, but also how well they work. And that's what I'll be going through. You forgive me, it does stray slightly into technical area, but I'll avoid it as much as possible. The justification, it's just not for the sake of doing it. We got stacks of data and just decided to go nuts on it. There was a good justification for it. That's slightly the justification. But the other reason was we actually saw big differences. As soon as we looked at the underlying data, we saw that there's a lot of differences between states and over times in what we called underlying risks. Stuff like practitioner characteristics and patient characteristics. Now, on the left-hand side up here, I have a map of the proportion of awards related to obstetrics, and you can see all over there's a large difference over the United States by state. The California, John mentioned on the left-hand side, is very blue. Florida at this other end, I think everyone knows where Florida is, it's one of the few, that's incredibly blue as well, very low proportion of obstetrics, whereas Illinois is the bright red one in the middle, who have got a history of problems with their caps in and out, is very red, a lot of obstetrics there. And I'll also point out Texas is quite red, and I point that out because we will come back to it in an example. There's a large difference between the underlying risks between states and over time, which I'll look at in a moment. So this sort of justifies the analysis of, well, we need to control for these sort of things. We need to control for the underlying characteristics of a portfolio before we move on to say, well, what's the effect of tort reform? The pyramid I have on the right-hand side, you may look at it and think, that's pretty stupid, because I have underlying risk sitting on top of something else. You'd think underlying should go on the bottom. I have been told that I think about things upside down, and I don't think this is an exception. I like to think of it building from the bottom up, from an insurer or a claims management perspective. There's a baseline environmental effect, and then you make your adjustments for the underlying risk if you were to build an estimate. From a modelling perspective, however, you do it the more intuitive way, which is to look at the underlying risks first, to control for all these factors, and then move on to look at the environmental effects, and specifically today we'll look at tort reform. But first let's look at the underlying risks and see what sort of information we can gain from this, as well as can we build a good control model before we start making further conclusions. So with the underlying risk model, we can roughly split the two main creatures into practitioner characteristics and patient characteristics. We're unable to do patient characteristics today. The data for patient characteristics has only been collected since 2004. It's pretty immature. We don't have a good enough time series to be able to control by this measure. But practitioner characteristics we have all the way back to 1992. So that's a great platform for building a control model. Particularly, we had a lot of changes in tort legislation, a lot of tort reform in that particular time. So specifically, we look at the sort of data we're looking at is allegation nature, which is a really good proxy for specialty, practitioners' age and experience, as well as some variables we've constructed ourselves, including the riskiness of a particular practitioner from their damage history and their adverse action history, like suspensions of licences and things like that. There's a technical graph over the side that comes out of the GLM. One doesn't need to know much about it besides that it's showing the allegation nature relativities from left to right, from anaesthesia over to treatment. And the higher you are, the higher average claim size you have. This linear predictor on the side, I wouldn't worry too much about that. It's the log scale of average damages size controlled for all other variables. And what we see is the obstetrics-related damages is 89% larger than non-obstetrics damages. So if you think back to that map we saw on the last page, it sort of justifies using a control because we do see very different behaviour between different specialties. So we would expect Illinois and Texas to have a higher average damages than we would California and Florida. We can push it a bit further and look at practitioner age as well that came out of the modelling. And this one's not just important from the control modelling perspective. I think it's quite interesting in its own right. What we see is that as the practitioner ages, as the practitioner gets older and older, the average damage sizes decreases. So they become, in terms of the claim size, given there's a claim, the claim size tends to decrease. When they make a mistake, it's not as bad. And to quantify it, it's about a 5.5% decrease for every 10 years of practitioner age. Now, you can see at the end here, I've got it all the way going down to 80. The 80-year-olds aren't necessarily that good. The confidence intervals around it are quite large, so there is every chance that that might be slightly spurious, but there is definitely a downward trend there. And the beauty of this graph is I think it really justifies the control model, because what we see when we look at the population in the US, and this is slightly different between states, but this is the whole US population, is that the practitioner age, the average practitioner age in the US has been increasing over time, particularly in the last 10 years or so. The average practitioner age has increased quite a bit. So even without any tort reforms controlling for everything else, we would expect to see that the average damage size decrease. In aggregate, the way this control model then performs is this red line here, which I've called crude, is John's graph. Sorry, John. And we can see what John was showing earlier, which is the average damages over the last 10 years across the US seems to have decreased. As soon as we control for the practitioner population, as soon as we look at these characteristics and take them into account, we then see that the average damages awarded is pretty much flat over those last 10 years with these demographic shifts. We've had a quick look at the patient data we've had since 2004, and that doesn't seem to change this too much. But as I said, it's still a bit immature to get solid statistically significant conclusions on. So in a way, this is our control model. I've taken a while to get there, but this is our starting point. Only now can we really get a nice picture of what the effect of tort reforms might be. Have we controlled for all the other stuff, or at least some of the other stuff going on? So we move on to the environmental effects, and specifically the a few specific tort reforms. We look at general damages caps, total damages caps, punitive damages caps, joint and several liability limitations, that is, how much each person is potentially liable for, and contingency fee reforms, how much lawyers are allowed to charge. Someone's phone's playing heavy. So we look at all these guys, and we look at them all together. So we don't allow them. They're essentially competing in models next to each other to what explains the best risks. And with 52 jurisdictions across the United States, and this 20-year time series we have, we're able to get a really good picture of each of these. I'll show the ones other than general damages to start with, because that's my highlight. So we'll do that second. I'll build up to it. The other reforms are there, and I've sort of said the states that they're affected by it, so you get an idea of the sample we're dealing with here. The total damages cap hasn't been introduced in many places, but punitive damages, joint and several liability and contingency fees have all been quite popular reforms over the years. And the effect on damages there is shown on the right. And the first three do exactly what you'd expect, I guess. They're decreasing the average damage size. The last one's a little more interesting, contingency fee reforms. And this is the hypothesis on this, which is difficult to gather evidence from with what's currently available. But the hypothesis is that under contingency fee reforms, where lawyers cannot charge as much, you'll see a decreasing frequency, but the actual average damage size will increase because they're more inclined to pursue very large cases and ignore small cases. And the general damages cap is the most commonly introduced of all the caps. So we're able to do a more nuanced analysis on this specifically, rather than just what is the effect of a general damages cap. We can look at the size of the damages to see what sort of impact it has on particular jurisdictions. It's worth noting at this point that I should have noted earlier is that when I refer to average damages, I'm talking about economic and general damages together. So what we see here is that a general damage cap does decrease. That might be me. The general damages cap does decrease total damages quite a bit if set low enough. However, it doesn't really translate well to the Australian market, but around US 700 and 2013 dollar values, it tends to have no effect whatsoever. So that flat line at the top there is just the baseline average damage sizes. The cap just doesn't bite at all. We see about a linear decrease down to around, until we get to around $350,000, at which time the general damages cap has an effect of reducing total average damages by about 32%. So a really, really significant and strong result, despite the underlying risk controls that we incorporated earlier on. So it was really quite comforting. And down there in that bottom corner, you'll see there is quite a bit of exposure, so there's good evidence from it, for it. That exposure includes California and Texas after 2004, so really big states contributing. I'd like to explain the model, I guess, from a larger... So we've looked at the individual components of it. If we're talking in terms of how well the model performs, I'll use a measure that I've called variation explained. Those interested, I can talk about how that's calculated later on. But this explains the total variation that we see in damages. And what we've seen is a very large portion, 31% of the variation we see in damages awarded, comes from the underlying risk model, that practitioner characteristic database. And this is not too surprising. If we know that it's an obstetrics claim, we know that it's going to be large. So the large percentage there in variation explains, not surprising. In total, on top of that, when we stack our models on top of each other and look at the total environmental effects, all the variation between states and over time can add an additional 12% of information. The tort reform, the five variables, the model that I showed you on the last slide, that contributes a total of 5%, or 45% of the total environmental effects can be explained by tort reforms introduced over the last 25 years, which is actually a large amount. I mean, they pale in comparison to 31% perhaps, but 5% in US medical indemnity is billions. So it's a big number. And so we were quite pleased with that result. I guess at this stage, I've tried to deliver a fairly disinterested look at the effect of caps and concentrated on how they affect average damages, but there's a larger story at play, and I guess it's the theme of the seminar as well, the balanced outcomes, that there's more effects of the cap than just decreasing the average damage sizes. And Texas provides a what someone like me would call a cautionary tale. Other people may think it's all right, where Texas introduced a stringently enforced 250K general damages cap in 2003, unindexed, and it's held up as the poster child nationally by the Republican Party as something that should be introduced across the states. And you can see why. The general damages went down. We'll see in a moment the award frequency went down. And also they had a 40%, over the last 10 years, they've had a 40% growth in the number of practitioners who want to go there. So they've really attracted the doctors back. There's a hypothesis, however, and currently difficult to prove with data, but we're starting to get more and more, that what's happening is that because of the very stringent low cap, we see this decreasing frequency, which John actually showed a little earlier for the new cap states. That decreasing frequency is actually limiting access for disadvantaged or lower income people. That is, because of the stringent general damages cap, and particularly in Texas, a fairly strict definition of economic damages, lawyers are quite hesitant to pursue cases that don't have a very large economic damages component. So the less well-off, so the stay-at-home parents, the elderly, and because of certain things in Texas, children have struggled finding representation to actually take medical malpractice cases to the court. So there are effects beyond simply decreasing the damages, and we tried to quantify that a little bit. You can see it only goes from 2004 because this is the patient data, and we have seen some decreasing proportion in the amount of awards to young patients, which is particularly interesting considering the amount of oncology going on in obstetrics, the amount of obstetrics going on in Texas, which we saw at the start. So that's a sort of a sad note. So instead of ending on that, I'll end on something a little sweeter, which is what we saw when we looked at that variation explained is that practitioner data matters far more, explains far more of the variation than tort reform can by orders of magnitude. What that tells us is that physician and surgeon education and type processes still remain the primary driver of medical malpractice insurance. We see this in anaesthetics, where in the late 80s, early 90s, they introduced all sorts of new procedures and really tightened up what was a pretty cowboy medicine. Is there a cowboy medicine? I'll call it a cowboy medicine. And you can see the proportion of claims related to obstetrics now has decreased remarkably over those 10 years after those reforms. More recently, there's the World Health Organization now and adopted around the world is the surgical safety checklist, which they call a timeout before every surgery to make sure things that as a patient you hope they do, such as the first question is, do you have the right patient? And the second one is, do you have the right body part? These are things that used to cause a lot of claims, which have now been tidied up quite a bit. So to bring it back to the first slide that you didn't see, it's possible to isolate and measure the impact of legislative change, and these insights are really improved by using underlying risk information. That underlying risk information, that practitioner model, is actually interesting in its own right as well. The general damages cap in particular has a significant impact, and we've been able to show this in a really neat way because of so many jurisdictions in the US, as long as it's set at a low enough level. At very high levels, it just simply doesn't bite. But one must always consider, of course, the effect on different cohorts can be markedly different from any sort of tort reform. Low caps may reduce, and I say may because there's less evidence for this than the damage size, may reduce the representation available to less affluent customers, which is probably not an ideal situation here. Anyway, that's it. Should I leave that up? No. Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ash and John. Definitely a lot of interesting content there and something for policymakers to think about when they are thinking about making large changes. Do we have any questions from the floor? If I can get you to use the microphone, I'm happy to hand this one out. Just we are recording a session. No questions? Are we shocked? Are we a bit surprised that it was that significant that you can... Yeah.
Just from my understanding, how do the contingency fees work? Is it a percentage of the total award, including care costs and everything, or?
So it does vary a bit between states. It tends to be a percentage of cost, but often you'll have to reach a threshold and then it'll be a percentage. And it's rarely capped at the top. There sometimes can be sort of a minimum level. So below a certain amount, you can charge X still, but once you're past X, it'll decrease proportionally. But it does differ a lot between states. So the plus 9% is And a lot of those ones where we the information on the left-hand side there, the conclusions are statistically significant, but you would expect small differences or variation between states because of the structure of it itself. John, you might know... is that it? All right.
Any other questions?
Katie Rogers from Finity Consulting. I think you said there was about 43% of total variation explained by the model. Do you have an idea of, if you added in the patient information, how much either the practitioner information or the tort information would reduce in terms of power?
Yes. So the early experiments on it, and that's all that's available to us at the moment, seems that on top of the... And if I was to, on top of the, within the underlying risk model, so if they're included at the same time, you could improve that about, 3 or 4%. And that is because often the patient information and the practitioner information, there's a large degree of correlation in there because different practitioners operate on specific patients. But certainly the practitioner information is more informative. On top of the whole model, it's pretty much so if you build the post-2004 model and use it as an overlay, the practitioner information contributes about the same amount. So it's pretty much independent from the environmental effects, which is somewhat surprising given there are demographic shift changes. But again, it's a pretty... Post-2004 is a pretty crude sample to be building on, given there hasn't been any real great tort reforms in that period. But it's about there, about 4 to 5%, not much more.
This last question, sorry.
Tony Mobbs. The last point there, which is that different cohorts have a different impact, can you advise whether it's been judged a political success, given that different cohorts are treated differently?
My gut reaction is there's nothing out of the United States that's considered a political success on both sides. It's either a tragedy or the best thing ever. Certainly, the Republican Party loved the Texas model for sort of clear reasons, and the Democrats hate the model. There's a rather sad map that we didn't put up because it's a little too sad. Is that if you were to overlay the amount of lobbying money, so insurers versus lawyers. Lawyers lobby to the Democratic Party and insurers lobby to the Republican Party, and it's pretty clear cut which states end up with caps and which states don't. Maybe that's a correlation rather than a causation, but I wouldn't assume. So political success, yes, it's got some traction. Obama's ruled out a cap at a national level, so not a great amount of traction, but some. Some. Certainly Rick Perry is very influential from Texas. So.
Okay, we might finish up there. Can we put our hands together and thank John and Ash?